Hi, welcome to another episode of Django Chat, a fortnightly podcast on the Django web framework. I'm Carlton Gibson, joined as ever by Will Vincent. Hello, Will.
Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Will. And this week we've got Paul and Alexei from JetBrains joining us, who are going to talk everything PyCharm and Django and all such things. Hi, guys. Thanks for coming on.
Hello, hello.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Thanks for coming on. Let's kick off. PyCharm, right? JetBrains is one of the big sponsors of Django Cons and big in the Django community. Tell us about PyCharm. What is it and why should we be using it?
First and foremost, we're an IDE, Integrated Development Environment. We are not necessarily a tech debtor. We try and take all the things that you do and bring them into one consistent user experience that's all supported by us so that you have one throat to choke. I can't really say that in a podcast, can I?
So when it goes wrong, we know who to come and talk
to. Yes, exactly right. Yeah. And it's funny, since the beginning of PyCharm, which was a long time ago, 10 years ago, it was positioned as the Python and Django IDE. So the Django support is mature. It's evolved. It's stayed current because people like Alexei put a lot of time into thinking about it.
Okay. And before we just dive into the features, can I ask a bit more about JetBrains? Because I go to the JetBrains site and I see PyCharm's just one of the options there.
What else does JetBrains do beyond PyCharm is what he's trying to say.
We have IDEs for most of the major languages. Maybe the biggest one is IntelliJ IDEA. That is an IDE for Java and Kotlin. We also have IDEs for Python, Go, JavaScript, as well as plugins for like Scala and Rust.
Okay, so is everything?
We also have backend services, TeamCity, things like that. And the point that Alexei's making is it's all built on top of this IDE platform. It's written in Java, but all the integrations are written with the native language participating. And so what that means is when we have killer Git support in the platform, everybody gets it.
Okay. So you don't need a Git client as well. So it's literally everything. It's as you say, it's one throat to choke. That's good. Okay.
Well, we want to talk about the Django specific features, but maybe if you could just fill out the batteries included, because I know you have database support. So for example, like I use Visual Studio Code primarily, but I've also used PyCharm. I know there's a bunch more that PyCharm does. Like, just what are the high points of what, you know, beyond an IDE that it provides as opposed to Visual Studio Code or Atom?
Right. So we have PyCharm Community Edition, which is free and open source, but it's aimed at Python. PyCharm Professional Edition gets you full stack. We bundle WebStorm, which is our IDE for JavaScript, HTML, and CSS. We bundle DataGrip, which is our IDE for SQL and databases. Some remote development stuff, some things like coverage, et cetera. And with PyCharm Professional and kind of the whole full stack thing, we say full stack from a programming language perspective, but we also mean all the activities running, debugging, profiling, coverage, VCS, database, all kinds of things.
Virtual that are brought environments, into the, right?
Yes, that's a very good point. Trying to ease the onboarding.
Well, because I know there's academic licenses, because I think 3 years ago I visited a local university that was using my book, and I remember asking them, like, how is the setup? Because I know that's challenging for people. And they all said, well, we're using PyCharm, so it wasn't an issue. And that was the first time, actually, I was like, oh, like, I didn't realize the full featured nature of it. And I was like, wow, yeah. It's a lot simpler than rolling it yourself.
Indeed. And you mentioned academic. It's also free for open source as well. And we have kind of startup discounts. We're still a human-sized company. And so we kind of we treat people the way we'd want to be treated.
Yeah. Well, and we should mention so Django has done the last couple of years a annual promotion with JetBrains PyCharm that's going to start in April, which is about when this comes out. And that's the biggest corporate donor to the DSF by far.
Yeah, we're proud of that. That started a good number of years ago. I think it might have started
I think before five.
Yeah, like right when I joined the company 5 years, the previous PyCharm product marketing manager, Dmitry Filipov, is the one who started that. And it really has raised a good amount of money. And some things fit people's brains. Some people don't fit people's brains. This seems to fit people's brains.
Yeah, I mean, just in terms of specifics, it's generally about a quarter of the DSF budget. So Carlton's one of the fellows. That's most of the money goes to Carlton and Marius, who's the other fellow. And it's generally around a quarter. So it's anywhere between 30 to 60,000 a year the last couple of years. So very material.
And just cranking up again, what, next month?
Yeah, so it's going to start the month of April. We're working with Roberto.
And what's the details of the offer? It's like, what, 25%, 50%?
Well, it's the same as before. So it's 30% off with the proceeds going to the DSF for the month of April if you go through the link.
Fantastic.
And, did I say that right, Paul?
Yeah, and to do the kind of full honesty perspective, how in the heck can you PyCharm give away something for free? Well, we're a subscription, and so we hope to see the upsides in the future years if people are happy with the product. But it is true, 100% goes to DSF.
Yeah, and that's partly why the DSF has done it, and it's the only corporate sponsorship of the type that the DSF does, in part because the DSF exists kind of to exist, not to make money. So as long as we cover our costs for hosting and fellows and conferences, that's the goal of the organization. But anyways, enough about the DSF.
Yeah, let's talk about features. So can I tell you my sort of top favorite ones from PyCharm? My absolute favorite one, which is closely related to my second favorite one. My absolute favorite one is there's a little down the left-hand side, there's a little structure button. And you click it, and up comes this sort of class diagram of all your nasty model layout. And it's like, that's fantastic. That's what I've been looking for years. And you can move around it, and it's even got a mini map. So, you know, when you've got far too many models and they're all joined up in horrible ways, you can click around the mini map to navigate. That's my favorite feature. My second favorite feature is in the gutter, down by the side of the editor. You've got this little button about and you click it, and it shows you all the subclasses and all the superclasses of the class you're dealing with. So I don't know, you've got my custom HTTP redirect response nasty thing, and you're like, oh well, I need to see what the base implementation. You just click that, and it's like, oh, here's all the superclasses. And you're like, that's the one I'm after, and you're there. And that's my favorite and my second favorite feature of PyCharm.
Well, that was great.
So go on. That's just an opportunity for you to now to spin off for 20 minutes and tell us all your favorite bits.
That's really hard to overestimate the importance of being able to easily navigate all over your code base. We are very proud of how it's actually done in PyCharm. And what I really enjoy is that it can be done not only through your just a Python code, but just navigating to your templates from your view to the view function from the template and to the variables that were passed to your template. That's one of my favorite things.
Right. So if I've got extends base, extends, you know, skeleton, extends, you know,
yeah, exactly.
And these magic strings and config files or route declarations and things like that. Essentially, we've taught the magical Django strings and conventions to be symbols as if they were Python. Right. And once that's done, all of our IDE machinery kicks in.
So that's where you get the autocomplete for model options. And
refactor, rename, and navigation, and all that stuff, find usages.
Okay.
Yeah, autocomplete is actually a whole story in itself because... Well, part of it you get from just a Python code, but due to Django's nature that you can't always have this information from simply Python. That's where Django-specific knowledge gets handy. If we know your models, if we read your code and understood it, we can give you like autocomplete for foreign keys, for example, that are not in the current model, but might be somewhere else.
And in many cases, the opposite of autocomplete, which is squigglies telling you got it wrong or you changed the other end and didn't change this end.
Yeah, okay. That's the thing. I mean, Sorry, go ahead, Carlton.
Well, I was going to ask, how, and so this is something that's come on over the last couple of years in the VS Code world with the what they've got, the PyLance extension here, which uses their the PyWrite type checker. And how are you able to say, oh, you know, we think we're better in this regard, or we think we're better in that regard? Like, how would I compare the autocomplete from the two processes? Because you've got a lot you've got 10 years of building the thing.
Yeah, true. It's hard to say for sure. I still think that we're somewhat ahead in this regard, and we try to evolve, of course. And yes. Having 10 years of Django support in the IDE, it sometimes takes some work to. How to say it better? Well, to make it work with the new features.
Okay.
And we adapt and evolve. And in fact, the imminent upcoming release.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about this.
Had basically a full-time PyCharm person, Lada. She worked on, we think we're great at autocomplete. And Lada's like, actually, right, we can do better. And so, like, total rethinking of the experience for typing a couple of characters and getting a deeply nested import generated for you, which is pretty badass because I hate stopping what I'm doing and going and typing my imports. Just hate that. But just in general, it's fun to see the rise in smart editors. It's fun to see the rise in Python providing more information to help smart editors. Whether it's fun to see machine learning giving suggestions for you is, I'm an old dude.
Yeah, get off my lawn. I know what code is.
Color me a little skeptical on this one, but the ability to not just give you a list of completions, but a short list of correct completions.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the challenge with search. I gave a talk at DjangoCon, the last one, 2 years ago on search. And the problem is everyone assumes Google is the baseline, and Google's a pretty high bar. So like, it's like when yes. people complain about search, I'm like, why don't you try building your own search? And then you'll start to see, you know, exactly as you said, it's like teeing up the right one is quite challenging. But you know it when you see it, right?
Yeah, back in the day, I had when I was doing CMS stuff, I converted a customer to use Postgres full text indexing, and I thought this is going to be great. It's transactional, and they're like, "No, it sucks." Great, it does search. It just doesn't do it astonishingly.
Yeah. Can I ask about so databases? This is something I've been really impressed by PyCharm, the integration there. So And specifically Docker. So like in one of my books, I use Docker because it is challenging to set up Postgres in particular on Mac versus Windows, and people get that wrong all the time. Can you talk a little bit more about the database integrations in PyCharm specific to Django?
For database integration, we actually bundle DataGrip, which is our IDE that is specific for databases. And yeah, so this is bundled in PyCharm Professional together with Django support. And once we have the connection to your database, once we know where it is, it's actually so we can provide you suggestions for example, for your column names. We can highlight your SQL queries and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's incredibly powerful.
It's pretty astonishing. You can be typing a SQL string, or as Alexei said, working on a model. You can navigate to the column. You can sit in your Python code and rename your column, and it will go and actually change your database. You can execute a SQL query right in the middle of your Python. It'll open up a panel, a console with the query results. And maybe, Will, your question was, what can it talk to? It's JDBC. So, you know, most anything that has a JDBC driver, which now includes MongoDB, we can provide this experience with.
I wonder, do you I haven't looked into this bit, but what's the sort of integration between generating a query set and then, you know, being able to map to the SQL that you're generating, and think about that? Because that's one of the hard bits where people are like, you know, if I annotate this, what do I get? I mean, got secret source there. I don't know.
Do you mean like watching what the ORM is generating?
Yeah. Yeah, that, well, I mean, because you can always, you can, so you can get query set explain, which was new in, I don't know, 3 point something or other. But it's one of the hard bits to, you know, when you get into advanced queries, it's one of the bits that people struggle. And you have to spend a bit of time. You have to spend a bit of thinking about how do I craft my query set exactly to get the SQL that I'm after.
Well, Carlton, how do you look at it right now? So outside of PyCharm, what's your way to visualize it?
Okay, so outside of PyCharm, I get in a shell and I go query set and I start annotating and I go, bam, explain. And I see, or I go query.query and I get the generated SQL string. And it's fine.
Yeah, it works, lovely, but it's not smooth.
It's a bit...
Carlton, let me ask you a question. Yeah. Do you think that string that's being generated is all the information available statically from static analysis? Or does it require some kind of runtime thing? I'll bet it is available from static analysis.
Yeah, because you... like the SQL compiler is... You know, it doesn't actually hit the database particularly. It's the parameters that you need. But like, you know, once you've got the model defined, once you start filtering and you add on the columns or you add the annotation, the actual compiling.
Because I know Alexei came onto this podcast thinking, you know, I'd really like to add a new to-do on my feature list. Wouldn't it be cool if you could do Alt Enter and convert a SQL ORM query to a SQL string?
Yeah, sorry, I'm kind of spaced out on thinking how we can implement this now.
Okay, so it'll be out by the time the podcast is live. Good. Okay, because that's one of my bugbears, right? It's one of the more difficult bits of Django, is when you're crafting these complicated ORM operations and you've got a nested subquery and then there's a window expression and exactly, you know, if I add in that rank function, like what's it going to start producing? It's like, to see that live, that would be, you know, that would really change the game, I think, to sort of be able to iteratively build your query set. Calls your ORM.
That's a pretty good idea.
Okay,
now that sounds like a hackathon idea, Alexei. We have internal hackathon contests.
I think what Carlton's getting at is, to me at least, I mean, query sets is sort of really what you do at an intermediate advanced level in Django. That's really kind of where most of the focus is on, is figuring out how to optimize them, how to craft them. Kind of the rest of it, I would say, is not as advanced. I don't know. That's my take. Like, models are models, views, templates, URLs, it's a little bit of whatever, but like the query set is kind of where it's all at once you get beyond a prototype, I would say. But I like sweeping generalizations, so.
No, I mean, it's true, right? It's true.
Well, we're in the business, or I'm an advocate, developer advocate, so I'm definitely in the business of sweeping unfalsifiable generalizations.
There you go.
We certainly, as a product, need to understand who we are for, who we're not for, what parts we have covered, what parts we need to be more competitive at.
Well, I don't think anyone's doing a good job on the SQL front. So
sure, and so that could be a good space for us, because targeting people like you, Carlton, where it's like, okay, the easy stuff is easy. How about giving me some help on the hard stuff?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of bifurcated, right? There's the beginners, for whom, if they have access to PyCharm, which I guess they do if they're a student, it's solved so many problems. And then there's that middle ground. And then there's the Carltons who are these advanced features. I suspect those are the two barbells of where you kind of focus. Is that accurate?
Indeed. And the Python developer survey that came out recently showed that there's a question about how long have you been using Python? And the answers were like, I don't know, under 6 months or a year or something.
There are a lot
of
newer people, yeah.
Yeah, it's like 150% of the people found Python yesterday.
Yeah, I was surprised by that. I was like, shocking. You know, because I was sort of, it almost made me not discount the results, but realize how many new people there are in the
data
space.
Science,
because there's a lot of other questions about your, you know, preferences as a professional. It's, you know, it's a a third new people. You know, actually, that Python survey, Django did our first survey in years last year, really modeled off of that Python survey. And we're going to do it again this year. Good. So actually, if you have any suggestions on what we ask around IDEs, let me know.
Okay, sure.
Because we'd love to, because we don't track anything really about Django. So the survey is a way for the, you know, fellows and the technical people to to kind of know outside of Django cons and message boards what we should focus on.
If you'd like to, let's set up a call and get you with our research team that can talk about the mistakes they've made over the years with the survey and what they've had to change to make it statistically sound and any other tips that they could give.
Okay, that'd be great. Yeah, we can do that offline because we had thousands of responses and it was literally a Google Doc I set up.
Yeah.
So yeah. We could do better.
So I'll ask this question back to Alexei. In regards to kind of that dumbbell thing that Will was just talking about, in looking forward to the rest of your year when it comes to Django, do you think your activities will be more about beginners or more about advanced?
It's hard to really pick a side here because what I'm planning for the Django. Well, part of what I'm planning is actually aimed more toward beginners, and part of it is, should be useful for both categories equally, I guess. So we plan to do some work enhancing the possibility to view Django documentation from inside the PyCharm.
Yeah.
We already have this possibility, and I really like this feature, but it's kind of obscure because you have to enable it specifically in settings, and we don't promote it much yet because there is some work to be done. But when it's finished, I think that it's going to be pretty good because we have the ability to go to your class hierarchy or to a symbol like in your settings file, and check the documentation that comes straight from the Django documentation website from inside the PyCharm. And it doesn't matter where you do it, if you do it for your views or for a string in your settings file.
And you should be able to build that locally, right? Because and for the particular version of Django in the virtual environment. So I'm running, on this particular project, I'm running 2.2 point whatever. I've got it.
Yes.
I can pull the documentation for 2.2 point whatever, and I can have that demonstrate. I mean, so I use Dash, which is, I think, just an awesome thing. And I have, I have it open all the time for documentation. But one thing it doesn't do is allow me to version by project, right? It's always got the latest one, but sometimes I'm not on the latest one. I need to see it. And so I have to go to the website. And okay, it's not the end of the world to have to go to the website, but it's not, right there and then. So if you could pull it locally and build, run Sphinx and
So the dream is to have it not only adapted to your version but to the specific element that you're searching for to save you like at least some seconds of looking through the page.
If you can index properly and pull out all those annotations that get you right. I know I'm looking at HTTP response. Where's the docs for that?
Exactly.
So that's the advanced feature, right? Because, beginners, they're too scared to look at the docs. They don't do that.
Yeah, that's kind of, that's my thing is that docs and tutorials are different things by design. So they go there to be confused and then they come to my educational stuff. But I think that is valid, right? I mean, because I've thought a lot about this, what is the difference between the two? And the difference is docs are designed for, Carlton has a question or I have a question and we go and see, this is how it's defined, as opposed to a tutorial or a book that says, let me start from the beginning and go through everything. And that's not what you need if you're, more advanced. And it's also so much work for me. It's like hard enough to do my things, let alone that, the Django docs are thousands and thousands of pages. So there's a place for both, I guess, is where I've come out after a number of years of doing this.
And so, Alexei, what was the other thing? Because there were definitely two things you were going to tell us.
Yeah, the other thing is actually a pretty cool thing that comes from to us from the platform. So sometimes it happens that we have an idea directly tied to Django. Sometimes it happens so that amazing people that work on the platform level have a cool idea to implement across all IDEs. And in IntelliJ IDEA, we got this thing called endpoints, which is basically your URL endpoints. And we have this for Django, like for your URL patterns, but this is so much more powerful when we can know your actual endpoints where your resources are located. We can do navigation. We can do auto completion, and not just in your Django code, but like for in your template, in your JavaScript code, anywhere. We can build diagrams of how they interact with each other. So I'm really excited about it.
So I'm thinking I'm trying to build, say, a dictionary for a request body for an API endpoint. And I need to do the request body, and that will be kind of auto-completable for me.
Well, the resource, the actual address of your view, for example, will be indexed and will be available to you across your projects, and maybe even across different projects that you have opened in the same frame. So, for example, you have two applications that need to talk to each other. We can, since we already tied your like templates and Python code to each other, why not tie different applications that are meant to talk to each other?
So like microservices kinds of things.
Yeah, or a client server example.
Yeah.
That's so amazing to see like a video demonstration of that, because I think I know what you're saying, but I'm sure you have stuff in the works to
I'm
to
exactly
show that.
Like you. It kind of bounced off me until I saw a demo. I'm like, are you kidding me? How do you know that? How do you know how to autocomplete that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I know what you're saying, but I'd love to see it.
That information
is not available. Just to...
Okay.
Yeah. Well, actually, that's... Go ahead, Carl.
I was going to say, what sort of timeline are you... If that's sort of this year, you think?
Well, I'm hoping to finish it this year.
It's shipping in the platform for the Java side. It's that each... Not only does each IDE need to wire it up, you got to wire it up to... Swagger Open API, or you got to wire it up to Django, or you got to wire it up to, you know, some GraphQL thing or something.
Okay, fantastic.
Alexei, is that right?
Yeah.
So can I cut bands slightly, because I wanted to talk a little bit about so from the IDE developer perspective, talk about some of the features of Python and then their application to Django, particularly typing, right? Because Django is really dynamic by its nature, and it's really hard for us to throw in type hints where you're just going to end up having any all over the place because, and at that point, it's not worth the price of admission. You know, if you've got a nice new thing, it's tight and it's, you know exactly the types, then type hints are beautiful. But something like Django, it's much more difficult. So what are obviously, those give you more static information, which enables you to make the IDE better. So, you know, riff off that. Where's the ground, and where would you like to see Django go, and what do you think is possible? And
well, that's true that for Django it's harder because there's so much more dynamic stuff going on. There's keyword arguments, there are attributes that are not really declared but added later. So it's really hard to express statically. Some of it might not even be expressible statically, but we've got a very good type checker that works off of Python, and then it has the ability for us to plug in into that with our specific knowledge of Django and say, like, I see you have this function, you have a filtering function here. Probably this is related to this model. Let's have autocomplete here. Let's have keyword arguments here. And it's always easier to do for stuff that is statically expressible.
Yeah.
But I understand it's not always the case. And we try to do our best for Django where we can. There is this project that is stubs for Django.
Yes, yeah.
Which is pretty great. And I'm hoping to one day use it for our own analysis to kind of enhance it. But so far it's been kind of hard because of the dynamic nature of Django, and because the stubs project is tied directly to MyPy and has its own MyPy plugin.
That was a Google Summer of Code project for Django last year.
Yeah. So because some of it is still done dynamically, we kind of have to figure out a way around it on our side.
Okay.
But I'm still hopeful.
I mean, there's one example.
In fact, you mentioned that summer of... I'm sorry.
Go on, Paul. You do.
You mentioned that summer of code. If I remember correctly, one of the first motivations for the DSF campaign with PyCharm, the fundraiser, was the money was going to go partly towards fellows and partly towards the static typing work.
Yeah. No,
this was years ago.
Yeah, no, it still comes up. It comes up on the mailing list. And didn't JetBrains, didn't they fund some work on it? And it's like, yes, but how is it to be done?
But it's hard.
we have this sort of idea that, hey, there is a chunk of money in theory available if we can do this, but it's just not possible. Well, it's not that it's just not possible, but it's a massive undertaking. And, you know, maybe indeed, we could smuggle in some bits in the internals where it's more tightly constrained and then, you know, slowly do something. But
it's interesting for me. I spent a lot of time in the front end world as well. I do big tutorials on React and TypeScript and test driven development. And watching TypeScript happen has been fascinating to me. If you thought that the Python people enjoyed loosey-goosey, JavaScript's like, hold my beer. Yeah. And yet TypeScript is now really popular in the front-end world. But in the beginning, I would read the TypeScript roadmap, and I'd be like, okay, first, I don't understand any of those words. They're using these type theory words that I don't understand. And second, I would think, okay, that's for Angular. Angular is the only one that has that problem. And gradually they've expanded the scope of their type system to be able to allow things like Angular and large scale React things to give a fantastic developer experience statically.
Yes.
Static analysis. And the world of Python just doesn't quite seem to be in love with static analysis the way that some of these JavaScript people have.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, you know, there are some big advocates, you know, Python core developers who are very big advocates, but equally there are, you know, people who are very big in the Python world who are, you know, quite vocally against going too far down the road. I think there's one thing from the PEPs which is important, which is that type annotations were always meant to be optional, even by convention.
Sure.
Even by convention.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a danger that we get to the, you know, sometimes when maintaining Django, there's pressure to put type annotations in where it's like, but they're meant to be optional. And you're not feeling that as a maintainer. You're feeling like, no, they're compulsory and you're falling behind the times by not putting them in. Yeah, it's like, well, hang on. The PEPs say they're optional, even by convention. So I don't know. It's curious.
Let me ask the two of you, as you do these podcasts, as you go out and talk, watch what's happening in the zeitgeist.
Yeah.
The world of Django is what percentage on board with using MyPy, adding type annotations?
Maybe 30, I guess.
And I don't mean the core team. I mean just in the wild.
I think people are sprinkling them in. I think... Using the type checker is not as prevalent as it can be. Because if you're not, what's the point of an annotation if you're not going to use the type checker? Well, the IDE gives you better autocomplete. That's why, you know, I'll just stick in an annotation on that variable and then I get all this
the thing.
I think people aren't using them too much. But again, you get these quite, because of the way Django is written, you get these kind of horrible annotations. You know, like I was writing some yesterday to see if I could get autocomplete to work. So I got, you know, it was in a PyTest fixture and I was returning a factory function from the PyTest fixture and I wanted autocomplete and it wasn't giving it to me. So I spent, you know, 10 minutes, 15 minutes writing this annotation. I still didn't get autocomplete. And I was like, but it's horrible. So I'm deleting it. And I don't know why.
Alexi's nodding. I think you know this problem with making autocomplete.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You know, I program in Elm and I program in Swift where these things aren't optional. And where you've got an ugly annotation, you create an alias and then you just use the alias and then it's slightly prettier. And there are things which I do without thinking in these other languages, which I'm kind of reluctant to do in Python. I think I need to just get over that. So I don't know about in general. I think it's coming. Python in general is increasing it. But I mean, Django's maybe not the right example because we've got this big history.
And, indeed,
and this big, like the core of the ORM, you try type into that, like
Yeah, sure.
It'll come. I don't know.
I don't see it as, you know, with beginners and intermediate, I don't obviously see it as much because they don't feel the need for it. I would echo what Carlton said. When I talk to professionals, it's pretty split. Some people are really into it and some people are very wary of it. So
It does help you reason about your code. If you take the time to think, what's the type that's being returned here? Oh, well, this is a callable that takes these parameters and returns this. And in fact, it's got a generic variable because I'm using it different times. And if I genericize it, I can create one version of this instead of four. And all of a sudden you've refactored your code because you spent a little bit of time thinking about the types. Yeah. And it's like, that's a win.
I mean, it's a bit of a religion. You sort of need to have the problem, spend the time, come to the solution, and then you're proselytizing for it.
Yeah.
But
yeah, right.
It's hard to say what percentage of Django people that applies to. Well, so I have a question for the... Oh, go ahead, Paul.
I stomped on your segue there. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask for the two of you. So there's so many features in PyCharm for Django. How do you think about prioritizing them, and when do you readjust, you know, the top three, top five, right? Because I assume the first question is, well, what kind of programmer are you? Are you a student? Are you a professional? So I guess, you know, you keep adding features, but you still can only hit someone with like 3 to 5 killer features. What is that process like? Because I imagine that's a challenge.
That is actually a big challenge. But for one thing, we have an open issue tracker. So it's always possible for users that have a need for some feature to come up to us and say, hey, I would like to have this. And we always look at what our users want. We talk to people at conferences. We try to find out what the workflows are, try to think about how we can actually enhance it, not just by, because maybe there is a better way that would be, that would include this feature in it, but would actually deliver more. So we have a voting system in our issue tracker. That's basically it. So we talk to people, we encourage people to talk to us about what they want and try to stay up to date with what's going on.
And how do you take stuff out? Right? Because you don't want to be AWS with 300 config options, right? And that's always the challenge, is you keep adding stuff. It's really hard to take something away. But if you don't, then it's a bloated mess for a new person.
That's true. That's been a challenge.
I mean, this is endemic to anything.
I agree. It's been a challenge for us, and I would argue that it's still a challenge in some areas. We still have some support for some things that we would probably prefer to take out, and I hope we would in the near future. Removed stuff from PyCharm, we extract it into a separate plugin and open source it if it wasn't already open source, so that people who still would prefer to use it can still do it.
And if I can add to that about how decisions are made about what to do, before each release cycle, there's a two-headed planning meeting, one a retrospective to look back at the previous release cycle, and then a planning the upcoming release cycle. And they actually do produce a list of top tickets with votes. And that is an important input to deciding what gets done. But one of the things we're learning is that we have a lot of features. We have a lot of features.
Right.
We could probably go and announce new feature in 2021.1, this thing we implemented 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And people would probably, we probably could get away with that.
That's what you were saying, Alexi. There's like so many hidden killer features, but you can only front page a couple to people.
Exactly.
So we're going through a big effort in the company to surface functionality, to make it so you don't have to know it's there. It presents itself to you in a subtle, non-irritating way at the right moment.
Like Clippy.
Oh, she didn't say Clippy.
Tap tap.
Yeah. Well, Carlton, that's, I mean, so, you know, dealing with deprecations and stuff, that's something, you know, Django and you spend a lot of time on trying to get right.
Yeah. I mean, you can't just break stuff. I mean, you can't, if you're Django, you can't just
break
stuff.
As you want to, right? Yeah. At night, you're just like, I'd love to kill this thing.
There are bits that, yeah, I take, like, the whole of django.core.mail, I just, like, you know, control delete that, and that could be gone, and people would find their own solution. But we can't take that out of Django as much as I'd like to. So, okay, that lives, and we maintain it, and we keep it, and we make a change. There's the deprecation policy and the deprecation period and all of those things. If you're a mature product, you've got to, you know, you've got to maintain that. I mean, you know, so this has come up in the typing conversation, to just cut back there, is we could make the types tighter in Django. You know, it's meant to be a string you get here. We could say, yeah, it should be a string, and drop the or any, but we can't do that because there are people relying on the fact that, you know, duck typing works and blah, blah, blah. So, okay, that won't change. I guess the same for if I was developing an IDE, what would I think? I mean, sometimes I still use an editor, right? So my other thing that I use is BBEdit, though. I have it open all the time, and I use it for any number of reasons. But one is, it's just an editor, and sometimes you just want an editor. I don't know. How do you maximize that kind of efficiency zone where you've got the features and but you're not, you know, you're not like flying a 747.
I mean, that's like a mental thing too, because I use a simple text editor. I mean, it's sort of like a, you know, a five-star chef wants to have a cheeseburger sometimes, right? Like, you just need to balance it out. But I think that, I mean, with Django, thinking about extra features, I mean, we have a very robust third-party package system, and that whole process of sometimes things can leave Django. Oh, yeah. What is it?
But Contrib Forms,
left Django.
Form Tools was taken out, and there was the doc browser thing, or the data browser thing, that was taken out. There, you know, there's no reason why you can't extract a package as a plugin. That's a great idea. You know, make it. It's still available. If people want to use it, they can maintain it. They can help maintain it. They can use it, but you're not forcing it on everybody. So perhaps we could make Core Mail a third-party package. That was a genius.
There you go.
I'm doing the Mr. Burns now.
Yeah, but it is that tension, right? You know, for any project. And I think the important thing is almost having the outlets. So having a way to deal with it instead of just saying no all the time or bloating out a project. Because certainly Django itself, like Carlton, you and Marius and everyone, really tries hard to keep it narrow.
Yeah.
You know, it's like one of the ones I get all the time is, why can't templates do more? Or why can't there be a front end thing? And, you know, it's a logical question for a beginner, I think. But it's also, it's already big enough.
Yeah, we can't, you know? Yeah, we can't maintain it at that point. So the other thing we do is we say, you want a new feature, build a third party package. And if it gets uptake, then maybe we can bring it into core. So you export features to plugins. You also can, you know, say, I think I want my own feature, and you're like, no, we're not adding that. Can I write a plugin for PyCharm?
Yeah, of course. And there are lots of plugins for all our IDEs for PyCharm as well. Recently, we had a poetry support added via a third-party plugin.
Okay.
And in that case, we worked with the person to add a couple of extension points, or to refine our existing extension points so that poetry could be included.
Okay. And
poetry is pretty hot right now. Like, I think the biggest thing for Django beginners is installing Python and setting up a virtual environment.
Yeah.
Because
same for us.
That is right? It's just, there's so many ways to do it. There's still a lack of universality. You know, pipenv project has an interesting history. You know, I still use it, but I debate it.
Ask Alexei what he's been working on for the past 6 months for PyCharm.
What have you been working on for the last 6 months?
Oh my god. I've been trying to refine our whole story about around packaging, because we have a way to install packages from inside PyCharm that is located in settings, like your interpreter, and the thing is, no one in our own team used it. to install packages in PyCharm. So that's a sure sign that something's not going right. So so we started rethinking this whole story. So we extracted the support for installing packages into a separate thing we call tool windows, like the thing you get for Git or for your terminal. We extracted it there with the possibility to browse the documentation for it, and we plan to do much more to tie it to your environment description, like for your requirements.txt file, to your PyProject.tom or whatever you're using, so that if you install package via PyCharm, you can just not care whether it's properly added into your requirement environment description.
What should Python do, right? The two of you, Paul and Alexei, you know, if you could make the PSF, what's the silver bullet to solve virtual environments? If you just had to pick one, what would you tell them to do?
Yeah, I would. I've been told by Lukas Longa that I'm wrong. So I will go ahead and suggest the failure approach. There's that pep pushed by Kushal Das about having a Dunder Py packages Dunder that's like node modules.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you don't even think of a virtual environment. There's no there is no concept of that. And in a tweet, he Lukas explained why I'm wrong, that edge cases and backwards compatibility and stuff like that. But my gosh, all of these, as a developer advocate, all I do is tutorials.
Yeah.
And they all start with the same thing. Like, here's 50 hours of janitorial work that I wish I didn't have to say.
Yeah.
Well, and the problem is they Google around, and then they have four different versions of Python because they download it directly, and then they did homebrew and this and that, and then their path is messed up, and then I have to explain path, you know, and then they're on Linux even though they're a beginner. And
Alexei
as much as
shaking
I want
his head like, I've just spent 6 months dealing
with
this.
You know, I think it's we don't want to blame the victim, right? I feel like there is a solution, and maybe it's there's a 90% case, and then there is a 10% case that if you have these issues, you go elsewhere. But I mean, Russell Keith McGee, you know, his keynote at PyCon two years ago,
Black Swans.
You know, one of the two things was we got to solve this problem, or we're going to lose to JavaScript or WebAssembly.
I agree. And if there was going to be a Python 4 that had a breakage, and there was only one breakage that could be allowed, this is the one I would break. We don't have to support easy install from 2005, you know, some obscure edge case.
There needs to be one story, right? Ultimately, it doesn't matter if it's this tool or that tool or the other tool, but there needs to be one story, and everyone needs to be using the same story, and all the tutorials need to have the same thing, and the Learn Python book needs to say this is the thing you have to learn, and for Node it's npm install, right? And although they've got Yarn now, so you know, perhaps it's not.
Well, it's like sort of it's basically the same thing, but I think that's just the case, is that I have a site, installpython3.com, and I actually own installpython4.com, that gets quite a bit of traffic because a beginner says, I don't care, I want it to work. And so as soon as we start saying the conversation we just had, we've lost them, right? It's like, okay, just get something working and then you can learn why it's hard. But it's really probably not hard if you're just starting out.
I'm curious Alexei's answer to this question.
Yeah, I was
going to
ask you, Alexei. So like a personal project, like a greenfield, you know, you wake up, cup of coffee, new Django project. How do you get things installed?
Honestly, I would just use PyCharm. I would just give it to PyCharm, like, do this thing for me.
Okay, just out of interest, what does PyCharm do? Does it use VM or does it?
You can select an option to create a virtual environment for you, or use the one that you created before it, and it would actually remember your choice and use it for your future project. It would remember the location of the, for example, .vnv folder that you suggested and use it for your future project. It would detect the one if you're opening your project with the virtual environment. So yeah, of course, lots of thinking is going into how we can simplify the project setup. We've added recently the possibility to install Python from inside the PyCharm. If you're opening PyCharm, you don't have a Python installed, you can do this. And it would look virtually the same as setting up your environment. You can just hit next several times and boom, you got a Python there.
And can I manage multiple Pythons?
Within one project, Carlton?
No, well, yeah. Okay, so this is my goal, right? And I haven't, and you know, so basic for base project, I'll use VMv, and I'll just use VMv, and you know that's it, you know, and I'm happy with that. And pip install with requirements file, and I don't want any of these other things because they're more trouble than they're worth, right? But then I need to test against Python 3.5, Python 3.6, Python 3.7, Python 3.8, Python 3.9. I need to test Django 1.11, 2.0. You know, I need to test all these different combinations. So I use PyEnv to get the multiple Python versions installed. And then I use tox to define this nice matrix for all the things, and I just run tox. And that's about as close as it can be. And that, what I haven't found is a kind of way of handling that smoothly in the development environment. So I want to quickly spin up a Python 3.6, Django 3.0, you know, I want to install that one. And tox have come up with a devenv flag where you can use it to, you can say, use this environment to create a development environment. And it's close, but it's still not perfect. And that would be somewhere where I would expect an IDE to step up and say, look, I can manage this matrix and I can help you create all the different ones, and I can activate this one, and I can be 100%, you can be 100% clear of which one on the matrix is activated now. That's where I think an IDE would pay value over a text editor, you know, where the text editor is not going to do that because it's out of bounds. But that's the sort of extra feature that I'm thinking, oh, does PyCharm do that? Because if it does, then it's, you know, really helpful. I mean, not necessarily yet, but that's my sort of holy grail that I haven't found. And you know, pipenv had different; it had a dev thing, but it just wasn't enough. It wasn't flexible enough. It was, you know.
Yeah. So the thing is, it's hard to both maintain several environments and have a consistent development environment set up. So, for example, if you're for sure, there's a possibility to have several interpreters set up for your project. You can easily switch between different ones. That, no problem about that. But what if your requirements file is not the same as the state of this interpreter? Should we suggest to install it everywhere there? Won't we mess up something in your next environment? So yeah, it's really hard question. It's the one that we're constantly asking. And I think we're trying to bridge this gap. What you described is a very good case. We're thinking about it, and I think we'll continue to do small steps in that direction.
Okay.
I'm hoping we arrive there someday.
Well, let me just give you one more nugget, and then I'll leave it with you to ponder on over the next 6, 8, 6, 12, 18 months. But the one more thing as I want is, okay, this is all going great, and I've got my environment set up and all the rest, but now I've got a really hard problem to debug. And I want to install various extra debugging tools that I just want to use for now, right? I don't want them in the virtual environment all the time, but I really need to solve this problem now. So pip install this, pip install that, pip install the other, fix my debugging problem, but then my virtual environment's nuked and I have to rebuild it, and in which version, which, you know. So the ability to layer on a sort of extra layer of debug tools just for the moment, that would be a kind of, you know, like cherry on the top. Anyway, I leave that with you to ponder, because these are the things I end up struggling with.
That's a thing that I'm actually working on at the moment, the one I talked about, the whole story around packaging. I'll add it to the list for sure.
Now, it's interesting, both of the things Carlton mentioned, there's a lot of, I don't want to say churn because that would be negative, it's actually positive churn in pep land about solving individual parts of the problem. They learned their lesson 10 years ago when they tried to do some big bang effort and it got rejected. I don't remember any peps about either one of these two problems.
Yeah. Don't try.
So I don't know where you would record it.
I'm not writing. I think, yeah, I mean, there is a lot of change now. I mean, so I think PyProject.toml has just sort of finally been given the blessing. That's going to be the way forward. And a couple of years, it's been like, well, do we want to add this to Django? Is this where it is? I mean, we just had setup.config, and we moved all the stuff from setup to Py to setup.config, and now we're going to move it to PyProject.toml. Is that going to be permanent? Or I think that will be permanent now, I hope.
And like Brett Cannon's doing a lot of work on PEPs to take really tiny, allegedly non-controversial things, get them encoded into that universe, and then everyone complains.
Yeah. No.
So I mean, poor Brett.
I find...
Yeah, it's thankless work.
Python's such a nice community, and yet every time the PI ideas and the Python ideas and the PEP world, it's really quite brutal. Mm-hmm. And
yeah.
I stay clear of it for this reason.
So are there any last points you want to either of you make that we haven't touched upon as we wrap things up? I mean, so people listening who say, oh, I've got a great idea, or I agree with that, I guess we can put a link to the issue tracker for PyCharm. Is that the best way to reach out to either of you?
Yeah, of course. Go to our issue tracker, create an issue, or upvote the one if it already exists. Leave us a comment. Describe your use case. The more information we have, the more thing we can provide.
Yeah. And there's a gem.
Okay. And we'll have a link, obviously. Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, there's a generous trial period and whatnot. Because I looked at the PyCharm website a few times. And I was like, should I download this? And then I was a bit scared by the form. And in the end, I clicked the download button. It was quite easy. And it just booted up and wasn't a problem, you know.
I mean, it's almost, you know, too easy. Because when I teach people, it's so tempting to just be like, well, just use PyCharm and all these things are solved. But because not everyone uses it, I have to kind of go the raw way. But certainly, I think that's starting to change. And certainly for students, you know, when I go into universities, it's overwhelmingly PyCharm over anything else, in part because, you know, they can use it for free, but because it does have all these features. And then, you know, sometimes I'm not as familiar with all the power features, so I have to sit there and go, huh, I didn't know that. Like, that's pretty nice. so it's educational for me as well.
I do this all the time. I do this all the time because we have so many features that we constantly discover new ones.
Yeah, and I manage the help manage the Twitter. And so I see someone pointing a tip out to someone else and they say PyCharm, so it gets in our inbox. And I'm like, oh, really? I didn't know that. How did I not know that? It's my job.
Same thing happens to me with Django. You know, people say, well, of course you must know this because you wrote books on it. But, you know, I just discovered this thing. And, you know, like yesterday that happened. I was like, well, I didn't know that about Django.
Yeah, people talk about imposter syndrome. I get paid to, like, be an expert for PyCharm. And I know maybe 2% of PyCharm. And I wake up each day and it changes another 1%. So don't talk to me about imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
My imposter syndrome can beat up your imposter syndrome.
Well, you know, Carlton shouldn't have any, but, you know, for me, conquering imposter syndrome is when you get to a point where people ask you questions and you like, I don't know. And then nobody knows. And so it's just knowing, being comfortable with not knowing, but having the confidence to say, well, I could figure it out.
Sure.
I think it comes about when you are a beginner and you don't know and you feel like you can't figure it out. So when you've ingrained that process of Googling and you have enough context to, you know, use the Django docs completely, I think that's when you overcome it. But when you feel like you hit a roadblock, that's where the imposter syndrome smacks people, I think.
I think you're right, but I think it applies at every level because, you know, I'm I work on Django all day and, you know, I have the code base open all day and yet I'll go to an issue on the issue track and it'll be some nasty in the depths of the ORM and there'll be two or three of the major ORM contributors there and I'll just be like, oh, I'm not hanging out in this club, this is too hot. But you know,
but that's my point, when people start asking you questions and you're like, well, I don't know, you know, that's when you're like, well, I guess I'm at the level of an expert because nobody knows.
I'm not, yeah. But you know, I think it's easy to feel intimidated in any level you are, and that you don't have you don't have the knowledge that it's like, oh wow. But you know, if push comes to shove, okay, I can get in there and I can get my hands dirty as well. But that feeling of doubt still lingers. That feeling of like, ooh.
Yeah. Well, hopefully that's something we do with the podcast, is having people on who are experts, and everyone says the same thing. So people listening know that this is just what it feels like. You know, it's like we just get comfortable with feeling stupid. And you almost, you know, it's like I almost get bored now if I know how to do something. I'm like, shouldn't this be a little harder? You know, like, because the muscle is so built up. Anyways, well, we'll have links to everything. Obviously, you can go download PyCharm. In April, check out the Django Project site for the free trial that benefits the DSF. And yeah, thank you both for coming on and sharing about PyCharm.
Yeah, really exciting.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
All right. We are at ChatDjango on Twitter and DjangoChat.com. We'll see everyone next time.
Bye-bye. Join us next time.